Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Metal Hammer Podcast. It is episode 129. I am Mo, and I'm joined today by both Elle. Hello, Elle. How are you doing?
Hey, good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Been better, but we'll talk about that in a bit, I think. But yeah, all else is okay. How are you doing, Jonathan? We've got Jonathan here as well.
I am doing fine.
Good. Doing all right. I'm glad to hear. We've got a lot to talk about today, for sure. Don't forget that the latest issue of Metal Hammer is out right now. It's got Metallica on the cover. SNM2 is out this week. We're very excited about that. And you can read my exclusive interview with the band about SNM2, about James going to rehab, and about what they've been up to in lockdown in the new issue of Metal Hammer that's out right now. We've also got a big thing with Avatar in the new issue. And if you're a fan of Avatar, you are going to want to stay tuned to the Metal Hammer socials, because you've got something else very, very cool which we're going to be releasing imminently. I'm talking in the coming days. So if you're an Avatar fan, look out for that. Loads and loads of cool stuff to get through. Jonathan, just before we started recording, you mentioned that you watched the Midgard's Blurk stream on the weekend. What was that like?
Yeah, it was fascinating and different. So Midgard's Blurk is the annual, I think it's been going for 5 years now, it's the annual festival, folk and metal festival, that's set in the Viking burial grounds in Borre. The Midgard Viking Centre. And so obviously, you know, one of the festivals that couldn't occur this year. So they did something different for the live stream, in the sense that, like, they only had one live band. And the rest of it was a lot of kind of discussions and talks, talking about kind of the history that, you know, that's involved with the festival, the history that that's involved with the Sykes. It's old burial mounds for an old Viking dynasty. They had some introductions, they had lectures. They took you into the reconstructed Great Hall, or the Gildahalla, as it's called, and they explained some of the carvings. They told some fables based around the carvings. And they had some really interesting in-depth interviews with Heilung, with Ishan, and with Dolk from Campfire, who played the European Metal Festival Alliance from inside the Gildahalla. The way this festival is always framed is with a big ceremony called a blut, which is a call out to the gods. It's a very involved festival. It includes dipping a birch tree in blood, so probably not for vegetarians. And you know, giving a call out to the gods or the deities or the spirits of your choice. Usually involves like a kind of a, you know, talking about the inclusiveness of the whole event as well too. And the guy who the two main guys in charge of these ceremonies, the opening and the closing ceremonies, are called Benny and Gustav, and they have their own band called Folktet Bortefor Nordvinden.
Wow.
Okay, we might have to get that.
Folket Fortivor Nordvinden. Folket Bortefor Nordvinden.
All right, we're going to have to get that spelled out on the reader.
Yeah, Johan Hegg from Amon Amarth is a big fan of them. He mentioned them, actually, about how affected he was by them in a recent issue of Metal Hammer. Hmm. And so they're very much in the kind of pagan folk vein, but it's very shamanic, very repetitive, not in the same way that Heilung are, but much more kind of a bit more of a stripped down version. And they play this kind of very sort of healing music, and they get, normally if they had a crowd, they have everybody on board with them, and he often gives like speeches about inclusiveness. Mm-hmm. And about the ethos of the festival. So this band, and Benny and Gustav, Gustav is a storyteller, they're very much like the heart and the soul and the ethos of the festival. So the whole thing took about 4 or 5 hours, and it was absolutely fascinating throughout, and not your typical festival stream, because, you know, Midgardsblot is a ethos as well as a festival. It's once you pass through those gates, you're into a very wonderful kind of realm.
Wow, that's cool. I mean, that sounds like a very unique stream. Obviously, we're kind of still seeing different festivals and gigs and bands find new ways to present stuff. And I can imagine that Midgard's Blurk is a very hard one to recreate because of everything you said about the tradition and the kind of the mythos and the ethos that it's kind of buried in. I actually, believe it or not, went to an actual real life gig this week. I know, an actual real gig with real people on a real stage. It wasn't a particularly Metal Hammer friendly gig. It was Rob Lynch, who's a kind of acoustic heavy singer-songwriter. But he's a mate of mine, and I knew a few people that were going down, so I decided to go down. It was hosted at the Signature Brewery in Walthamstow. So what they did was they kind of opened the brewery right up. It's a really tall industrial kind of warehouse thing, super high ceilings, and they opened the back doors out. So it was nice and aired out, and they had everyone socially distanced and sat at benches and stuff. And it was really, really nice, to be honest, just to be in a room with people. Jonathan's tripping around his bedroom for some reason while I talk.
Trying to drown out what sounds like a tractor. It's actually a lawnmower next door.
Oh dear. Go away. But yeah, it was really nice. It was so nice to be in that kind of feeling of just sharing an experience with people, and had a little bit of a sing-along, although I didn't go too hard on that because I'm still not sure what the thing is about spreading germs by singing in the current climate. But yeah, we still had a nice little time, and he also played a David Brent song, so that was a bit of me. I really enjoyed that. So yeah, I know that Jamie Lenman is doing some of those Signature Brewery gigs this week as well, so yeah, it was just awesome. It was really nice to do something like that. I don't know how many more opportunities there'll be to do that, but it was just nice to do something that just felt normal, I think. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It is. Like, I feel like that every time I go for like a walk with a friend or something, I'm like, oh, it's a normal person. I feel normal again.
Doing normal stuff. I know it's going to be a little while yet before we get to proper gigs again, but I'm sure it is coming. And yeah, it's just nice to see some things that are kind of, you know, advancing that and showing that we are moving forwards. We are moving forwards and upwards out of this madness, slowly but surely. So yeah, I mentioned earlier that we had a bit of a shitty day so far, and that's because we all woke up to the news that Riley Gale, who was the frontman of Power Trip, passed away last night. We still don't know a whole lot about exactly what happened, other than the statement that the band put out at the start of the day. Which said, "It was with the greatest of sadness we must announce that our lead singer and brother Riley Gale passed away last night." So yeah, this is a real shock. Obviously, Power Trip are a band that we here at Metal Hammer have supported very heavily. We had them on the cover back in 2018. We had them on the Metal Hammer tour featuring Trivium and Code Orange and Venom Prison before that. And they're a band that we're very invested in and we love very much. As someone who had interviewed Riley a few times over the years, I felt this one quite keenly. It's always horrible when somebody that young, 34 years old, passes away unexpectedly in the metal scene. But when it's someone that you've kind of talked to a few times and feels like they are kind of in the orbit of Metal Hammer quite a lot, it just feels all that more pertinent, I guess. It's just an absolute shocker. So obviously our thoughts are with Power Trip and Riley's friends and family. As we say, we don't know what the whole situation is right now with exactly what happened. It's just a real shitter for that to have happened. And Riley, to me, was genuinely one of the coolest people to interview. He was a fantastic frontman, really made that band come to life on stage. But he was also an incredibly intelligent man and a very passionate and empathetic man. And I mean, I think I interviewed him 3 or 4 times, and I feel like we covered more ground in those interviews than I have covered with some close friends, because he had so many opinions and so much thought on so many different things that it was always a pleasure talking to him, and I always really enjoyed our time chatting to each other. So yeah, an absolute shitter on that, but I suggest everyone go out and blast some Power Trip very, very loudly today, because they are one of the best bands that we've seen in metal in quite some time, and I'm sure we'll find out what the future might hold for them from here moving forwards. But yeah, what a shitter, eh?
Yeah, and they were kind of part of the thrash scene, but they always seem to be something more than that. It's not easy for thrash bands to kind of feel contemporary, because they always sound as if they're just trying to sort of copy a certain era. But Power Trip have always felt very much of the moment and very contemporary. And a lot of that's to do with Riley's intelligence and his lyrics and just, you know, the level of engagement he really had. Mm. And yeah, it's gutting. It's just taken away far too soon.
Yeah, it's a real shock to wake up to this morning. I think if you've seen them live, and you know, we had them on the Metal Hammer tour, you know, as well, like you said, as being contemporary, as him being so educated and knowledgeable, and by all accounts, a really amazing person. They're just a brilliant modern new band as well. Just a brilliant person, a brilliant band. It's a really sad loss.
It is, yeah, it is. And as I say, if there's any updates on it, we'll kind of take those as we come. So we don't know the full situation, but in the meantime, yeah, rest in power, Riley Gale, and thanks for a quite astonishing back catalogue of music you gave us in quite a short amount of time. Right, what else has been going on? There is some good stuff going on this week. We should talk about that as well, for sure. Do you want to talk about this Trivium stream that's coming up, Elle? That looks quite interesting.
Yeah, so obviously Trivium did that amazing live stream a few weeks back that was all kind of bells, whistles, full stage, actual production. The most professional stream that I've seen so far. And now this Saturday, they're going to be live streaming a show called The Deepest Cuts. Mm-hmm. Bassist Paolo says, "We are taking you into our jam room to give you a Deep Cuts Trivium set of songs that we rarely play and a few that we've never played before. It'll be totally free to watch on Matt Heafy's Twitch account. And there'll be exclusive merch too."
This is cool.
Have you had a look at The Deep Cuts? There's some really cool stuff on there.
I have, yeah. I mean, what... I think what's really, you know, as we all have, I've been watching Trivium for 15 years now. So I feel like I've seen quite a lot of their stuff get played. I've caught them on most tours they've done as well over the years. So there's a few cool cuts in there that I think I'm pretty sure I've seen them play live already. So what's really promising to me is that the songs I'm most excited about are actually the new songs that I haven't played live yet. I said leading up to the A Light or a Distant Mirror stream, really wanted them to play Scattering the Ashes because that's my favourite song on the new album, and it looks like that's going to be in this set, which I'm really excited about. So I'm definitely going to be, if not tuning in live, I'm definitely going to be finding that and watching it back afterwards.
Yeah, it's got some of the older ones that I love as well. It's got Ascendancy from right at the beginning and The Revanchist from my favourite Trivium album.
That's in a sentence cut?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, they've done a real like
slightly more of my favorite than the new one, but yeah, Scatter in the Ashes, I want to hear that too.
Banger. Yeah, they've done a really good spread of tracks from across their career, which again just goes to show what an amazing catalog they put together, really. Yeah, looking forward to that very, very much. In other interesting news, Kerry King seems to have some new music on the go. He told Dean Guitars in a brand new interview, "I've got more than two records worth of music, but to be able to go through that and pick the best 11 or 12, that first record should be smoking." So it's cool that he's calling it his first record. So obviously, I don't know if he's thinking about this as a solo album or something with a new band or what. But he's also added that, "I'm the only lyricist because I'm the only one writing music. I'm not positive who everyone is that's going to be playing with me. I've got to pick those songs and start trying to put lyrics on them to move the process forward." So yeah, new Kerry King music. Are we that surprised that Kerry King is continuing to make stuff after Slayer?
I'm not surprised, but I'm curious about him being the lyricist and what he's going to write. Is he going to write about snakes?
Why not?
Because that's one of his passions, right?
Yeah, he loves a snake. He loves a good snake. Absolutely. I'm interested, man. Like, Slayer is Slayer, but Kerry King is Kerry King, and I'm sure he knows his way around the good song without anyone else involved. So we will have all the updates on that as soon as we can.
I'm sure he's going to get some interesting collaborators as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're not going to say no, really, if Kerry King asks you, are you?
No.
Yeah, exactly.
For a variety of reasons.
He's a scary man. Actually a very nice man when I met him. Crowbar. So this is, obviously, we know that music venues and bars and everything else have had a really shitty time of it during this pandemic. And one of the most iconic metal bars in the world, I don't think it's any exaggeration to say, Crowbar have posted an update on their situation. This is like London's premier metal bar, renowned around the world. Dave Grohl's drunk in it, Lars Ulrich's drunk in it. I once went to a little town in Georgia and they'd heard of Crowbar, even though they didn't seem to know a single other thing about England other than that. And they've still not been able to open in the pandemic, which sucks. but they have just put a ton of new merchandise out. So if you've ever been to Crowbar, or you want to just show off an iconic brand and pretend you've been to Crowbar, head over to crowbar.merchdirect.com, because they have been an absolutely essential part of the metal scene over the last 20 plus years. And already had way too many metal bars closing down and all the rest of it. So yeah,
London would not be the same without the Crowbar. I've had so, there's always like, when I used to go, there's always like your night would take a turn that you weren't expecting. It was always like, crossing this threshold, and you'd end up with some kind of weird adventure almost every night. I've been there with the guys from Immortal, taking them in there, and the minute Motorhead came on, they went on the dance floor, sort of pulling poses. Been there.
Robot doesn't have a dance floor, does it?
Well,
it kind of does.
Yeah, you know, on the back part. Sure. And yeah, it's just legendary, and it's just. It's a genuinely rock and roll place.
It is. And it's got a long association with Metal Hammer as well. There's Golden Gods Awards in there. There's a Metal Hammer banner that used to hang up right on the ceiling. My best Crowbar story that I think I've told you already is that I once met Lady Gaga in there, of all people, which is ridiculous. So it is an absolutely iconic part of the music culture in London, and we want them to be able to come back. So if you fancy helping out, go to crowbar.merchdirect.com. I know there's a lot of places to support and everything else at the moment, but I'm sure if you've ever been to Crowbar, you can appreciate what we're talking about. Right, let's do this week's album of the week. Now, I'm going to be transparent. I haven't listened to as much of this as I would have liked to, because we had the news about Riley this morning, and that kind of threw my plans a little off the rails, to say the least. But I know that there is a man who has lived in this album quite a bit and can tell us quite a lot about it. And that is Mitty Johnson Seltzer. So tell us about the new Ulver album, Flowers of Evil, because the last record saw them take this really fascinating dip into a much, much more kind of 80s pop-centric, kind of almost gothy vibe. They've kind of kept that going on this album, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. It's very much a continuation of Assassination of Julius Caesar. So when I first heard it, I wasn't quite sure what I felt about it, only because it was kind of, maybe it's because of the similarities. Sometimes you think it takes you a little while to get to hear an album on its own terms, and without it kind of comparing it to the previous album. Now, everybody loved The Assassination of Julius Caesar. Everyone I know, no matter what part of the metal spectrum you're from, there's just something really unifying about the music they were kind of recreating, but the spirit in which they did it. Everyone was comparing it to Depeche Mode, which I thought was just like, what are you on about? It's just like, you can hear a little bit of it, but that wasn't like the main, for me, there wasn't the main influences. The spirit I got was actually bands like Talk, which is an 80s pop band. They were kind of atmospheric, and they went off into completely sort of beautiful, slightly more left field territory. But the last album that was pop, which is which is The Color of Spring, and it has this really rich sense of sort of utopianism, but poignant and sad at the same time. And you can kind of hear that in Flowers of Evil as well, where it's just, it's got this like very rich sense of wonder and texture, but there's a kind of a poignancy to it as well. Mm. And it's a bit more subdued than Julius Caesar. And it's a bit more understated, which may be why I was kind of looking for like, what are the standout songs? But the more you listen to it, the deeper it gets into you. The singer Christopher Rigg, his voice is so rich and sonorous. But you also have to remember, this is a band that started off as one of the original black metal bands, one of the foundational black metal bands. And that they've managed to change so much over the years, going through kind of more cinematic periods, more left field periods, even doing an album of like 60s covers, and still kept everyone on board. Even all the old school black metal fans, just shows that, that the spirit in which this band have evolved has been so genuine and done with such amazing craft that, no one's ever accused them of selling out. in any way, shape, or form.
Also, it'll be a weird way to.
Talked at the same time.
Oh no! You go.
Just with you talking about obviously them being one of the original black metal bands and so influential. There's a really nice line in one of the songs, on the opening track actually, which is called One Last Dance, and it's one last dance in this burning church. And like you said, his voice is very sonorous and it really stands out and kind of rings out really clearly. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. And the album, it kind of like lyrically, like in the last two albums, you notice how much he mentions dates and times.
Mm.
It started off like it was 1935 in Norway or something.
Loves it.
This album just kind of like floats kind of around history, and it feels like it's trying to tell you something important, but you're trying to patch this narrative together.
Yeah, definitely. There was one that was it 1989 or something, and he kind of sets the scene. And it's one of those albums as well where all the kind of lyrical impressions blur together as well. So something from one song will blur into something else. And you get that, it's like the assassination of Julius Caesar. You get that kind of collage of times and places all overlapping. So you're kind of not quite sure what happened when and kind of what's going on. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how they do one, they tend to follow one album that's very dynamic with one that's kind of in a similar vein, but just a bit more smoothed out. Like one of my favorite albums of theirs is called Blood Inside, and it was kind of really playful, but the amount of dynamics they have would jump off from one to the other. And the next album, Shadows of the Sun, was really sad and just and poignant and plaintive, and it didn't have those dynamics, but it had something else, like a really wistful quality to it. But just this, listening to this record just makes me feel happy and slightly sad at the same time, but just in a really wonderful combination.
Mm. Wow, awesome. Well, that is an album that is out on Friday, Flowers of Evil by Orba, on a fascinating journey that just still seems to surprise us, which is awesome. As I say, I've only heard the single so far, so I'm going to dig straight into it, as you guys all will, on Friday. It's quite a busy day for new music this Friday as well. Venomous Concept have a new album out. Seether have a new album out, if that's your thing. Narrowhead as well. They're a really cool band, kind of 90s, kind of shoegazy kind of rock band. They have a lot of interesting stuff going on. I think we're going to do a little something with them later on. And, of course, some of you may check out the new Metallica live album, I guess. S&M 2 out on Friday also. And then once you've done that, as I said, don't forget to pick up our latest issue as well to read all about it. Let's do some reader questions now from facebook.com/metalhammerreaders. Love chatting to you guys on there. That community just keeps growing and growing and evolving and evolving. It's great to see. Scott Satumple asks, if the Queen asked you for a metal song recommendation, what song would you pick?
I would pick Enter Sandman. Because why are you laughing at me?
Because I think I like the fact that you've taken this as I'm going to get the Queen into metal. What's the best song to do it?
Yeah. Because it is one of those ones where you're like, you know, if you have to get someone to metal, what do you choose? And Metallica are like the biggest metal band, and Enter Sandman is a banger, and it's not too difficult for people to grasp onto. So yeah, basically what you said. But apart from that, there were some other considerations. There's no swearing in it, so she won't be offended by abuse of the Queen's English. And also, it's got a prayer in it, and the Queen likes God. You know, she's the monarch who's sworn in with all the prayers and things, and you know, the national anthem, God Save the Queen. So I think she'd quite like I Pray the Lord My Soul to Keep.
Wow, yeah, she'd love that. One likes the chorus and the bit about God, not so keen on the heavy bits.
Yeah, and basically I that.
But I get beheaded for that. I hope not.
I reckon she could headbang.
Do you?
I reckon she'd be into it.
I'm not sure her crown would stick on that quaffed head.
Jonathan, what are you playing the Queen? You've got one metal song to play for her.
I'm going to go on the lines of be careful what you ask for. So I'm going to play A Throne Below by Watain.
Jesus Christ.
Just to say that you think you're on the throne in this realm, but it's not the one that matters.
Wow.
Arrested straight away for that. Arrested.
My Jonathan, dad. Wow.
Chucked in the Tower of London. I was trying to think of, again, I didn't get quite as much time to think about this as normal, but I was trying to think of a metal song I like about queens and kings, and the only one I could think of was King Nothing by Metallica. So I just play that.
There's also King by Satyricon.
Yeah, it's a good
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah, I love that song too.
Wait, hang on. What about Rob Flynn as well? Did he have Killers and Kings?
Killers and Kings, yeah, he did. Yeah, you're right. That's a good one.
About songs with queens?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to think of.
I googled that and it just came up with the band Queen. It was hard, and then that's as far as I went.
Yeah, I literally, it's all just Queen everywhere. Someone do a better job with this than we have.
Maybe she doesn't want to hear a song about being a queen because she's a queen all day, you know. Maybe she wants some escapism, which is where Metallica and Enter Sandman could come in.
There you go, everyone wins, hooray. David Inglis asks, how important do you think the visual aspect is to the overall experience of a live gig? For example, pyro, backdrops, digital screens, outfits and makeup, etc. What do you reckon?
I think it's important, but it depends on the band. So some bands, you just kind of want to see them in a sweaty club and it's all about the music and just having a good time and messing around. And some bands, it actually defines them. If you look at a band like Rammstein, they're defined by their pyro and their live show. And some people actually go to the shows not even really knowing anything about Rammstein, but just wanting to see the spectacle. So you can't really take that away from them now. And then you've got bands like Tool who don't have pyro, but they have, you know, really swirly visuals that define them and their personality. So I think it's on a case-by-case basis, really. It depends who the band is and what they're trying to achieve, but you know, if you've got a good band, it should be able to, the music should be able to stand up to anything, whether you've got production or you haven't. But some bands are enhanced by production, no doubt.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's got to be symbiotic. Obviously, you know, yeah, Tool are a really good case in point where, you know, the performance, you know, like the visuals are part of the performance. Maybe it's also because... you know, Maynard James Keenan doesn't really like kind of performing that much, but sometimes even if he's standing at the back of the stage, he's part of the whole performance, like when he's dressed in blue, when he's a silhouette, you know. And other bands, see, I still don't really understand Parkway Drive. I know the visuals are really exciting as far as, because pyro is exciting, but I feel like I don't really understand how that fits in with what Parkway are about.
I think it's just the whole like going hard thing. Like the last two records just go really, really, really hard. They're very hard hitting subjects and hard hitting emotions. And it's really heavy music. And I think they've said, haven't they? They saw Rammstein's show and they thought, we want to have a piece of that. So I think it's just kind of enhancing what they've done in the last couple of records by adding that in there. And I think it does enhance it because there's more of a sense of drama about them now than there used to be. You used to think, oh yeah, you'll watch Parkway and that'll be good. And now there's kind of more of a drama. It feels a bit more grown up. It feels a bit more like a spectacle. It's got more, there's more tension in the air as they're coming on stage. I definitely think it brings something.
The thing is, they've always been a brilliant live band and they were always kind of beefing up those production values as each album went along. Like I remember on the Atlas tour, they were doing that thing where like at the Roundhouse they came out and as that first drop to is it Wild Eyes? Whoa.
Mm.
Yeah, as the first drop to that, they just like, I don't even know what a better way to put it, they just spunked out all this like confetti and like silly string from these cannons everywhere, but in a way where it didn't like it came out so fast and so hard that you were suddenly like whoa, and it was like the whole place was just suddenly covered with all this stuff. The way they did it was really cool. I hadn't quite seen it done like that before. So they've always been thinking about those live elements. But as their show has evolved to kind of get, like Elle said, drama is definitely the best word for it, more dramatic, more kind of grandiose, their music has evolved with that. And so the stuff they're doing, like the whole thing of Winston coming through the crowd, carrying a torch and all that stuff, the spinning drum kits and all this shit. Like, I think they've done a really good job of making that feel like it's all part of the Parkway Drive thing, because now they've gone from being a great live band because they just played great and everyone had a great time at their gigs to being a band where every new tour cycle, it's going to be like what they're doing next. What's the new live show going to be look like? And I don't even think people really do that for Slipknot so much, really, because Slipknot is so kind of visually, you know, tied into their masks and stuff. You're not necessarily expecting Slipknot to do something specific with each tour. And the only other bands I can think about that do that are Maiden and Rammstein. So I think Parkway have done a really good job of putting themselves into that. But to answer the original question, yeah, it just depends, doesn't it? I don't really want a Kiss acoustic show, but I also would like to see, I don't necessarily want to see Pyro if I'm watching, like, I don't know, Jamie Lenman or something. Like, it's just these things have to kind of work a certain way, I think.
I'll tell you what, like when you go to Roebourne, because they have this huge screen behind the main stage, I've seen some, and they do kind of special, like one-off visuals for particular sets. And some of those have really been absolutely mind-blowing, whether it's the Salim Lamouchi tribute after he passed away, whether it's Waste of Space Orchestra, and had kind of amazing special visuals. It's really, so that these, so they become kind of like one-off multimedia experiences. And yeah, Roadburn was really good for doing that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's really cool when festivals can create those kind of one-off things. And Roadburn seems to be like the Mac Daddy of that. Yeah. I feel like you should answer this next question because it's something you have particular interest and also experience in covering.
I can answer the question.
Go on, then.
I read the question as well.
I'll tell you what, let's spread the love. Jonathan, you read it. Elle, you answer it.
I'm going to read it, but I'm not going to understand. Right. Many claim that rock is dead, but if you check the Japanese rock and metal scene, the genre is thriving. You've got bands like X Japan, Maximum, The Hormone, and Galnerius, who have had some international success. But then you've got all-girl bands like Band Made, Love Bites, and Baby Metal, who make great music and have become popular due to their YouTube videos going viral. Do you think these bands don't get the attention and support they deserve because they rely on some sort of gimmick? Or is it because people relate to any music in Japanese to anime?
That was Daniel Playtez that asked that one, by the way. Thanks, Daniel, for a thought-provoking question. What do you say, Elle?
So I'm not sure if people necessarily relate any music in Japanese to anime, but what I would say is that I think the anime community are largely the ones who turn out to see Japanese bands when they play in the UK, because I'd say they probably have more of a fascination with the language and culture than maybe metal fans do. But that's obviously not to say there's not a crossover between metal fans and anime fans, because I'm sure there is. But I think if we're talking about general kind of metal music fans, there's probably a few different reasons why maybe those bands haven't been embraced as much as some of those bands, possibly relating to cultural, language and geographical divides. So X Japan, which Daniel mentioned, they're a really interesting band. If you haven't seen it, go and watch the documentary We Are X from 2016, because they've got a crazy story. But they were massive in Japan in the 80s, and it was their dream to break big in the West, and they never did it. And now I think, sadly, modern music has moved on, and they still sound kind of 80s and flamboyant and dramatic. So they're a great and interesting band, but I'm not really sure that contemporary audiences here will relate to them very much. But yeah, you should check them out anyway, because they're really interesting. Maximum the Hormone, I think there's probably a problem there with them barely touring in the UK. So, you know, they haven't toured here since 2008 when they came with Enter Shikari. They did one show in Islington in 2011, it looks like. And they're a band that sing in Japanese, and, you know, you have to kind of seek them out, I think, really. They're not going to be sort of put in front of you necessarily. And there's some other bands in Japan who are brilliant, and, you know, they've never come over here because it is a long way to come and tour. It's very expensive to come and tour. I saw this incredible band called the Wagaki Band in Osaka, who are really, really amazing. They do these incredible shows where they even have martial arts displays in the middle, and they kind of fuse together traditional instruments with rock and metal. And they're amazing. And I saw them a few years back, but they've not ever come over here. They've played a few shows in Japan, a few shows in the States. But if you like the sound of that, they have got a new album in October called Tokyo Singing, which actually includes a new song called Sakura Rising with Amy Lee on it. So there's a chance maybe there that more people are going to hear about them and actually might pick up on it, which would be cool because they deserve that. And then Daniel also mentioned girl groups like Band Made, Love Bites, Baby Metal. And he also said maybe they don't get the attention they deserve because they rely on some sort of gimmick. And I do think that's true in a sense for Baby Metal. I think there was like a sort of mistrust of them for being gimmicky. But I feel like they've sort of embedded themselves in the metal scene now and people don't really argue about it. Band-Made maybe has seen a bit more of a novelty. And Love Bites, I feel like are crossing over a bit, you know, because they played Bloodstock and they've sort of been embraced. So I'd say that maybe like the girl bands, as you called them, are kind of being embraced more now and not just seen as kind of a novelty band. They're actually part of the metal scene. So I think things are changing. But I would say, I think it's just difficult really with the kind of distance between here and Japan and the language in a sense. You know, if you haven't got a band coming over and playing with the bands you usually listen to, or if you can't, you know, if you've not got kind of a lot of information about that band in front of you, you might not know them. So I'm kind of hopeful that people are embracing more Japanese bands now. But yeah, I guess it's all, it kind of depends on the band really, doesn't it? I'll have to see.
Yeah, totally. I feel like Love Bites stick out quite a lot on that last thing as well, because, you know, as much as we all love Baby Metal and Band-Made are cool, like those are certainly bands that have been put together with a bit of a gimmick or kind of, you know, it's a bit of a different vibe. Whereas Love Bites are literally a band that just play power metal that happens all from Japan. Like, that's it. Like, so I think it's not surprising that they've crossed over in a slightly different way, because they're just a metal band who happen to be, you know, made up entirely of women from Japan. That's it. It's not quite the same thing.
I think they've got more of a Western sound as well. And I think some other bands like the one Jonathan mentioned, I actually had to Google, I didn't know them, Galnerius. I Googled them and they've got, excuse me, more of a kind of like, it's more like a sort of dynamic sound. And there is a kind of, to some Japanese rock and metal bands, there is kind of that more sort of dynamic feel, which is a little bit different to kind of the genres we tend to adhere to in a sense. I'm not really articulating it very well, but there is kind of a sort of, I don't want to say, it's not like power metal, but a more kind of soaring sort of rock and metal sound, which you probably wouldn't put in any particular genre box. And over here, maybe we're a bit obsessed with kind of going, this is thrash metal, this is death metal. And
There's certainly Japanese pop melodies, like as an undertone throughout Love Bites music, you can hear that. Just some of the keys and the chords they use. I wonder what happened to Deer and Grey, because they seem to be the band that kind of predated all these bands, apart from obviously X Japan, but they were the ones that kind of made the first inroad with this whole kind of J-rock thing. And I got asked to see them, not knowing who they were, in Germany. And yeah, the amount of attention they got, and the amount of absolute mania from the fans was really kind of off the scale. Mm. And the fact you had all these people singing along, in Japanese. A lot of people come from Sweden and to Germany, because those were the places where they music got imported or exported to. Some of the time signatures were not your typical Western time signatures. So there was kind of something a bit off. There was kind of obviously a bit of a psychological thing going on with the singer, where he cut himself from the inside of the mouth and was talking about really personal things. And yeah, that seemed to be the one band that seemed to like predate the big Japanese wave, and they were kind of huge in their own bubble, and they seemed to have disappeared.
No, they still exist. They played, according to the internet, they played Islington Academy in February of this year.
Yeah, just I think whenever they play, it's just that the fan club gets all the tickets, so it doesn't really get out past that. It's very much kind of in a bubble.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mentioned when I'd sort of, a little bit of what I meant when I said there were sort of Japanese bands being embraced by anime communities. When I've seen Japanese bands before, and it usually tends to be at the Islington Academy, it must be something about that venue size or links with certain management companies. It usually does tend to be people who are kind of from that community, or perhaps, you know, like you said, obsessives of that band. And I think for those bands to get really known outside of those worlds, they need to be doing support slots with other bands, which Dear and Grey did, you know. I'm not sure kind of why they sort of dipped down again and kind of fell off the general radar a bit. I think, you know, distance and exposure really play a role in this.
Sure. Interesting thoughts indeed. I guess we'll see which of those bands can continue to pick up some kind of momentum. There's definitely a lot of potential in a lot of the Japanese metal scene right now anyway. Sam Welch asks, if you could put together a special issue covering just one band, who would you pick? Would it be Route One and pick an established name or a slightly smaller band to help give them the first step towards headliner status? I guess this is just carte blanche here. Like, what would you like to, if you could just have, if sales didn't matter, if you just wanted to do whatever the fuck you wanted, what would you like to do a whole magazine on?
Well, we already kind of did it a little bit when we did a Rammstein magazine. So,
good point.
We did, like, a ton of Rammstein content, the early years, Breaking America, the music, the lyrics, the show, deep dive on Till Lindemann. And I was obviously heavily involved in putting a lot of that together. And that was really cool because it was just like immersing myself in Rammstein world. So it is really fun doing specials on bands that you really like because you can really like dig inside them. We were just talking about baby metal then. And the one thing I'd really like to do with baby metal is do like a deep dive and go to their hometowns and see where they grew up and really get to know them as people. But as we know, they're characters really rather than people in the music, and they're very heavily guarded. So we do speak to them, but that we speak to them as characters in the band baby metal, not as people outside baby metal. So that will probably never happen. But yeah, I'd love to do it on some of my favourite bands like Deftones, Nine Inch Nails, and then smaller bands, obviously. The one we always talk about is Code Orange.
I've got Code Orange down here.
Which would be cool, and just kind of, again, I like doing kind of the hometown things. They're fun. If you could go to Pittsburgh and kind of look around their haunts.
Because they're one of those bands that have really created their own world, and I just think you can just dip so far into that.
You could go wild, couldn't you, with like Matrix visuals and stuff. That would be really awesome.
Definitely. I mean, we wanted to do a Code Orange cover this year, but the timing just didn't quite work out because of when their album was due. But we had the kind of space then, it just didn't quite work. But obviously we did get Jamie on the cover of last month's Hammer, which is cool. But yeah, I'm sure there's still more to be said about that. What would your cover look like, Jonathan?
Well, I'm torn between what kind of approach, like either a band with a long, obviously I want bands with long histories, but one whose history is kind of like part of a bigger story or indicates something bigger. So one of which would be Mayhem, because it would be kind of be a history of black metal. Also, they have the most amazing stories. And you know, every album was kind of very different from the last. They're all kind of like, it's a very turbulent history. They're all like really interesting characters. Yeah, they all have a kind of, every album has its own story to it, and it makes a much larger narrative. So that would be really interesting. And but also, you'd want bands where like every album feels totemic on a kind of a psychological level. Like every band, every album kind of is a marker point for where they are. So I would say either Converge or Neurosis, because they both represent a particular kind of very sort of hermetic kind of scene in a way. Plus, you know, both really emotionally open and unguarded and elemental. And I just think the journey from each of the albums would each have its own story. I know Neurosis have like amazing stories about Through Silver and Blood. I'm sure Converge have amazing stories about, you know, Jane Doe and a lot of the albums that came out there and the whole kind of scene that they came out of as well too. But you know, they operate very much to their own, both bands operate much to their own laws. So I think those would be really amazing stories. And also, you know, Jake's such an interesting front man. Nate is one of the funniest people on the planet, Nate Newton. So I just think that would be, they would all make for amazing narratives and stories.
Yeah, I would read the hell out of that. Well, both of them.
Artwork as well, because doesn't Jake Bannon do like artwork as well?
Yeah, he does all the artwork, not just for that, but for everything. He runs his own label, Deathwish Inc. So he does the artwork for pretty much every band on that label.
That's awesome. I'd love to read that. Yeah, I mean, your guys' ideas, I think, are possibly better than mine. I mean, I had Code Orange down here again because I feel like you could really, you know, I was just thinking about world building bands, and I think Code Orange have absolutely done that, and you could just have so much fun with that. Yeah, Ghost came to mind, obviously, because there's just already so much history and storyline and characters and color and imagery, and there's just so much you could play with there. So I really love that. This wouldn't be one that we could do for Metal Hammer, but if I would love to read a proper dedicated, insightful magazine dedicated to the Prodigy. I feel like, you know, they always get coverage and they've always kind of been around. And I know that other magazines go deeper on that than we would, but I don't feel like I've seen that kind of definitive, all-encompassing take on them yet. And they were just such an important band, such a culturally significant band. And they've just been through so many interesting deviations in their career that I would love to read that. If anyone wants to, like, you know, hire me on the side to do a bonus Prodigy mag, I'll do it. Guys, anyone? Cheers. But yeah, I would read that. And I'd read the hell out of all of yours as well. I think that was a fine bonus commissioning idea session. We just got courtesy of Sam Welsh. Thanks, Sam. That is it for this week's episode. Thanks so much for joining us. Thank you for joining us, Ellen Jonathan.
It's my pleasure.
For joining you, Merlin, unless you're multiple people.
Thanks. yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for supporting us. And go out and play some Power Trip today very, very loudly.
Do it.
You are. Cheers, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Another time.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.